morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 142 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Clarice Lockery.
I'm Amon Warman.
And I'm Hannah Flint.
This week, Amon speaks to future Oscar winner, maybe, we'll see. Daveine Joy Randolph about her role in Alexander Payne's seasonal tragicomedy, The Holdovers, while we review the film, plus we chat Mean Girls, the movie musical, and the Jodie Comer starring apocalyptic drama, The End We Start From. And in our hot take, we take a look at those BAFTA nominations. But first, let's talk about what we've been up to this week. Hannah, I know what you've been up to because I was there, so.
I robbed a bank and she's my accomplice.
I knew it.
I was in the getaway vehicle.
Drive, Clarice, drive.
My toothpick and my scorpion jacket.
Any police listen to this, I was not involved. Please do not include me.
Amon, you got us the blueprints. What do you mean? You're our safe guy.
Why would you do this to me?
Yeah, okay, sorry. Yes, I did do something that was... I hosted the first film club with... and we had Asif Kapadia screen The Warrior. Is that your first time watching it, Clarice?
Yes, and I'm so glad that he said that you asked him and he mentioned that it was based off Japanese folklore, because I was watching it going, oh, this feels very like, you know, Japanese story, folklore. And then I went, is that just because I've been playing Ghost of Tsushima for a week? And I felt stupid. And I felt, you're so dumb, Clarice. Shut up. And then he said that. And I went, no, I shouldn't doubt myself.
Yeah.
I was correct in having that vibe.
And I'm so glad that I helped you realize how smart you are. Because you're a smart cookie.
So intelligent.
Yeah. No, he was really good. And we had Vathana Shaganya Sapia, who screened her short film, Ratham, Blood. Mm. Did you like this? There's a bit in it, and I mean, I'm not to give it away, but there's a bit in it where I really feel like it's going to go one way and it doesn't. And it really made me well up a bit. And it was like, oh, it had made me choke a little bit back in a sob. I thought it was just like that. There was a really, interesting scene about periods within the Tamil culture and kind of coming of age ceremonies. It was really interesting.
Yeah, because I guess I didn't know a huge amount about the specifics of like the ceremony and the period blood and how that's evolved. And B, I love like this. It was really, the conversations they have are so awkward and real, and I really like just the little moments between the family, even though it's encased in this like, you know, very very kind of traditional kind of strict setting. Just the interactions are so like kind of delicate and awkward, and I thought it was great.
Yeah, and they were both there. And Asif, I love Asif. I interviewed him before, but he gets so candid.
Yeah,
like we record.
He's so funny.
He's so funny. He's so funny. He was such a sweet kind of came down, brought a load of old posters. He was like, I've got a load of old posters. Some of them weren't for The Warrior, but they were like Warrior in like, I don't know, Hungarian. I thought that's so cool, or Spanish and stuff. I was like, God, I want those posters.
Wow.
For Creature. But he stuck around afterwards and chatted to those people. Yeah, and everyone had a really good time. And I guess, oh God, we've got to work out who we're going to do next for our next first film club, because so far we've had a really good run, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's recorded. We recorded the Q&A. So I'm going to, at some point, put it together as a second series of the podcast. But that was fun.
Amon, you probably did something more exciting than I did. You go first.
I did go to the O2 this week. One of my older brothers, he's a singer, and he does this thing. That's this thing called Young Voices, which is an annual thing. Sort of, it's the biggest kid choir in the UK, essentially, and they all descend upon the O2 for a couple of weeks. Actually, they go on tour across the country, and they're playing a couple of hits at the O2. And my brother is one of the three sort of professional singers that they had on stage, sort of supplementing the kids. I was there at the O2 supporting him doing that, and he was awesome. They also had Nandi Bushell, who was this incredible kid drummer, like 13 years old, played with some of the most biggest artist ever in the world. If you go and look at her Twitter feed, she is so unbelievably talented. It's crazy. And she did a set.
Is she the one Dave Grohl?
Yes.
Yes, I know who that is.
So she was there. She did a set live. Cool. And she's just phenomenal. Phenomenal. I was so glad to see her do that. I didn't know that was coming at all. That was probably the highlight of the week, aside from this, of course, which I really enjoyed.
I'm still stuck on that your brother's a professional singer and it's the first we've ever heard of it.
Have I not told you this?
I don't think you've told me this. I mean, I think you need to give me like a pecking order of like the Warman family names, jobs, occupations, social security numbers.
Oh my gosh, wow. Like the one sort of who's slightly older than me, Akiem, he's like a professional pianist, and he has toured with huge artists. But now, for the last like few years, he's released his own piano albums and played his own gigs. I've been to a couple of those. That's been cool. Then the one above that is the professional singer who does stuff here too. Then the one above that is the one in Australia right now. That's where I went to visit and to hang out with over Christmas and New Year's. We're all fairly talented individuals taking over each industry one at a time. I'm joking. But yeah, we're good.
When are you all going to form a band
together? I'm not sure if the world is ready for that. No. I'm trying to think what I would be in this band. I don't drum. I used to play piano. I stopped after like grade 5.
That's pretty high grade.
Yeah. I used to be able to play Oscar's Boogaloo.
Why didn't you pick it up? Once you learn, I guess it doesn't... I say that. I don't think I could pick up a bassoon again in Knockout.
You used to play bassoon? I did not know
I got to grade 2 distinction. And then I gave it all up for my basketball career, and look how that worked out.
I love it. We're just peeling back layers of the Hannah onion and the Amont onion today.
It was the most stupid instrument to get, though, because it was like, I got it because no one else played it, so I thought, I'm going to be cool. And it was like the least cool instrument. So I was like, oh, this makes a very foghorny sound. I mean, it's quite good. I was pretty good at this point. But then you're like, I used to leave it on the school bus all the time. And I like, because I think you put it, big, and I put it in the front luggage rack. And then I get off, I'm like, no. And so like, and then I go to my lesson. I just have to like practice like with the reed. Like, like Mike and like Mike and Friends. Hey, if you're a real jazz pianist, you can play without it. I'm doing the impression. But yeah, and it was also really boring because I remember during orchestra. Sorry, I've got a real segue here, but like, I remember during when I was in orchestra, and the one fun thing was that they did the Star Wars prequels. You know, from the Phantom Menace. You know the final kind of bit where they win.
Yeah,
that bit. We had to play that in the score. And I just,
but then it gets kind of spooky at the end because it's the Darth Vader march.
Yeah, but I guess it's when they're on Naboo and they win or something. Anyway,
And the scene's playing.
I just remember this. Remember the sparkle, the glittering. Like there's like a glittering thing. I remember it like from the pan in. God, we're such fucking nerds.
And proud, Clarice. What hidden musical talents do you have?
Oh, well, I never did lessons for anything, but I was in a band and played bass guitar. Okay.
Oh, yes, you did.
Hannah was like, I can see
it. I don't want to be rude to bassists because there's some very talented ones, but it's actually quite easy to do the bass if you're not, you know, if you're not showing off, because you're just like,
yeah, because there's four strings, isn't it? Whereas like the six string, it's just like, how do you get? Someone's trying to show me how to do like a C the other day, and I was like, my hands look like I'm doing Twister, like I'm playing a game with Twister on my like. It's just a weird.
I mean, I could play a little bit of guitar, I could play a little bit of drums, but I was mostly bass. I guess my thing I trained in was ballet. Maybe I'm a secret assassin. Who knows? All the ballet's good for.
Red Sparrow.
Yeah. And that Ana de Armas, I forgot, it's coming out this year.
Oh, well, yes.
The Ballerina.
Spin-off. Ballerina.
Very excited about that. Her one action scene in No Time to Die was the best scene in that movie.
Well, like, Ballerina's not out yet, but we are going to talk about the movies that are out now and available to watch, starting with The Holdovers.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
Every year at Barton Academy, students, faculty, and staff depart the campus for a two-week winter break. But there are always an unfortunate few who have nowhere to go for the holidays. They're known as the Holdovers.
Mr. Hundam.
Hello, Mary.
I heard you got stuck with babysitting duty this year. How'd you manage that?
You know, he used to be a student, right?
Yeah, that's why he knows how to inflict maximum pain on us.
Christmas, the snow's coming down. Christmas, I'm watching it fall. Christmas, lots of people around. Christmas, baby, please don't come home. Christmas, dee, 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 dee. I think, you know, I was thinking back on some Christmas films I grew up watching. Home Alone introduced me to a lot of Christmas songs that I still remember now.
Oh, because that's in it, isn't it?
Yes. Pretty sure.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Sleepless in Seattle. Right. And it's like, and she's in the thing, and she's on the, I can't remember, just in the car, and she's like, horses, 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 horses. I'm like crying. I can't remember what song that is, but I always think about that every Christmas.
Yeah, this could be a Christmas classic, but we'll get to that in short order. The Holdovers, a curmudgeonly instructor at a prestigious American school who is forced to remain on campus during Christmas break to babysit the handful of students with nowhere to go. Eventually, he forms an unlikely bond with one of them, a damaged, brainy troublemaker, and with the school's head cook, who has just lost a son in Vietnam. This is directed by Alexander Payne, from a script by David Hemmingson, and it stars Paul Giamatti, Dominic Sessa, Davine Joy Randolph, Kari Preston, and Brady Hepner. And as we said, I got to speak to Davine earlier this week. She was in town. She's been doing a lot of awardsy stuff these last couple of months. And for good reason, her performance is one of the highlights of this movie for me. So it was really cool to chat with her. She was a little bit jet-lagged because of all the flying and the interviewing that she's done. But her answers are pretty good. So this is a really fun chat. And I hope you enjoy listening to it. Me and Davine. Davine Joy Randolph, welcome to the Paperback Podcast. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, I'm good. Congratulations on this movie. I really, really liked it. As somebody who spent 5 years in boarding school as well, there was a lot of recognizable, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Which is really good. This is a holiday movie, so I feel compelled to start this conversation asking, how were your holidays?
My holiday was nice and peaceful and chill. I kept it simple because I knew that I had to do all this press stuff and traveling.
Right.
So I stayed at home and kept it nice and chill.
Nice. With this film, you said that it's a very different character from who you are, which I find interesting because I know what Dolomite is, my name, which is a film that I love and I love your performance in. That character is more closer to who you are, to your truth. When you're playing a character that's different to who you are, does that change your process in any way compared to a film like A Dolomite Is My Name?
Process, no. The process is still the same, but it might take a bit more digging.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, checking and balancing within myself to make sure that I'm not reverting back to something that is more familial to me.
Yeah. Which is more freeing for you, doing stuff that's away from yourself or doing stuff that's closer to who you are?
I enjoy both of them because they stretch me. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if I'll pick over the other. But I really like diversity. I like creating all these different characters versus like being known for playing a certain type.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like you're getting more of that diversity of choice now that you're getting more successful, which is great. I think in a lesser creative's hands, the character you play in this film, it could have leaned into magical Negro tropes, which I think you are aware of. Did you have any discussions about that with Alexander Payne?
Uh,
Yeah.
No, because from reading the script, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just reaffirmed that I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
I don't ever do that.
Mm-hmm.
I won't accept a role if I feel as though that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I just make them very aware very early on. Mm-hmm. If that's what you're looking for, I'm not your girl for it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just, listen, these tropes are from like the 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
The fact that we as a culture still have these same tropes from the 20s and 30s, that was 100 years.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I refuse.
Yeah. And yet we still get, I mean, Green Book wasn't that long ago. And it did what it did, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the cool things that I found out as I prepped for this is that you cooked the food that you ate, which is really, really cool. Mm-hmm. I have a question about eating on screen and if there's an art to that, because I've heard many different stories. I've heard some actors work with, like, spit buckets after takes and stuff like that. Is there an art to eating on screen? And how often did you do those takes where you had to eat?
I think the easiest thing is just don't eat too much.
Yeah.
You know, just don't pace yourself, because if you want that scene to be where that person is shoveling it in, you're going to have multiple takes of eating it.
Yeah.
So hence the spit bucket. And the, I just, even if my character has to eat something, I just keep it really simple.
Yeah.
In smaller portions.
Yeah. But yeah, that's really, really cool. Have you gotten to learn any other skills like that for a role that you can still do?
I don't know. Other skills. I mean, this one I had to do quite a few. Between the cooking and the smoking and the dialect. And that's another thing that I think made this special. All the different skills and stuff. That's fun for me when you get to dive into a character in that way and, you know, have to learn new things. And I don't know if I've learned as many new things for a role.
Mm.
I'm trying to think.
That's cool.
Don't. Not one's not coming to me right away, I'll say.
Mm.
Oh! It's kind of dark, but I had to learn. Okay. I had to learn how to shoot multiple types of rifles. Mm. I have an action film coming up.
Yes.
And so I had to learn the different guns. And we trained with an ex-Marine for like 3 weeks. And that was intense. But I'm grateful because now I'm very aware of my...
Yeah.
Surroundings, but yeah, that was probably the most that I had to like really learn a craft, and like how to take a gun apart, how to put it back together.
That's awesome, because in prepping for this, I saw an interview I think you gave in 2019 where one of your goals was to star in an action movie.
I did start saying that.
And now this is manifesting. This is
why
great.
Why did I say that? No, I'm trying to think. I think it was because a thing of like, you wouldn't normally see someone that looks like me doing that.
Mm.
I'm always looking for that. Whatever, what have we not seen in a while or ever, I want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Many of my favorite moments in this, in terms of acting from you, it's sort of silent acting.
Mm-hmm.
And even what you're putting into the mm-hmms that your character says at times. I love those moments. Were those very apparent to you on the page, or were you figuring that out as it went along?
I wasn't told that we were going to have silent scenes. So that was new to me. And so we kind of like collaborated, figured that out together. And, you know, we shot those scenes. We would shoot it in one sitting for like 45 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, so eventually the beautiful thing is the camera disappears and you're just in your environment and they're taking you in. And then I would create like internal monologue and let that those different things be conveyed. Mm. Hopefully they did on camera. Mm-hmm. And then everything else, I just let it come the moment, arise to that occasion.
Mm. I love it. I love it. It's great. Thank you. This film takes place in the 70s. Dolomite Is My Name is another film that takes place in the 70s. So you're very well acquainted with that era now. If you could bring back something from that era and bring it back to today, what would it be?
The clothes.
The clothes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The pants, the suits, the accessories, the material. It's just so different. Mm. Such great quality. Yeah, the clothes.
Yeah, I think Ruthie Carter probably agree with you. And then collaborated on Dolomite, and I'm a massive fan of hers. Her work on Black Panther as well.
My everything.
Yeah. Has she commented on your clothes in this? Has she watched it? What's she said?
Yeah. We're texting back and forth, texting what I'm going to wear for the shows. Yeah, no, she's my heart. She's amazing.
She's awesome. This is a very theater friendly film. If you could perform one of the scenes in this film on stage, is there any particular scene that comes to mind?
Yeah, I would love to do that kitchen scene on stage.
Yeah.
I think that'd be really fun. And I could really like be throwing stuff and all over the place. Yeah, that'd be fun. And to feel the audience captivated, you know, by it, I think that'd be really cool. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the audience. When you're in the theater, you can immediately sort of feel the room and see what the sort of impact is. With this one, not only because it's a film, you don't have that, but there's no video village, so you can't even look at your performance on screen. Mm-mm. How was that to sort of get across mentally?
At first, it was daunting because it was different. And then it became freeing because there's no judgment.
Yeah.
Just, you know, we're workshopping this. We're trying out options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was that first screening like when you saw your sort of finished film? I imagine that was that the first time you saw anything? The finished film?
Yeah, they wouldn't let me see nothing.
Wow.
And I was the last person that saw the movie. I saw it like days after the strike ended. And we were officially about to go into press. Mm. And it was overwhelming. And then the music has a whole other layer that deepens the script. That we didn't know about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not like we're acting and then a song just starts to come on to inform us of the mood. So, it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I like that. Like Paul Giamatti, you went to Yale. And I'm curious to know, even though you guys sort of generations apart in terms of your Yale, were there any sort of similar exercises that you guys did?
To me, it was like we were of the same voice, same mind. I sometimes see working with a new scene partner, kind of like boxing, you know, sparring, seeing their moves, getting to know them as an artist. And what was so interesting to me is that we were in many ways on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
That's very exciting.
Are you able to sort of pick out, you probably went to Yale once you sort of acted with someone after a few minutes, and what are some of those characteristics if you're able to do that?
I've never worked with anybody else that went to Yale. Well, Sanaa, but I never worked with anyone else that went to Yale. I don't know what it is.
Mm.
I don't know. It's just, because I don't want to say it's like, you know, better than anyone else, but... Mm. It just feels like a language, like of just of like, oh, you literally speak the same language as me. Mm. That's familiar. I don't know. I mean, I have a guess, but I don't want it to then sound like I'm saying Juilliard and NYU and Yale is everything. Some may say, but I don't want to be the person that says it.
No worries. It's on the record. We're not saying that. A lot of the stuff that I've been reading in the wake of this is, in my mind, rightfully, when's the lead role coming? That is what the people want. Is that something that you're thinking about and what that looks like?
I have really enjoyed playing supporting because I feel like they're allowed to be fully fleshed out and exciting and fun. I'll be honest with you. I do think that would be cool and all. Mm-hmm. There's a tiny part of me that's nervous mm-hmm. that the character, not nervous, maybe disappointed mm-hmm. that I won't be able to have as much fun.
Right.
Because a lot of times the lead is used for exposition and mm-hmm. clipping the story along and, mm-hmm. you know, stating the obvious. But what I've had so much fun in doing supporting is really be able to create these characters mm-hmm. And nuances without the pressure of, you know,
mm-hmm.
being the lead. Yeah. So I hope I don't lose that mm-hmm. when that time comes and that I'm able to, you know, have mm-hmm. that, still have that presence of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be good. This season, the last couple of months, has been awesome. I've exchanged a number of messages with some of my colleagues about is how awesome it is to see you getting your flowers this season.
Thank you.
Did you always think that this moment was coming, and how does it feel to be in it, navigating
it? I didn't think this moment was coming. I'm really just so grateful that it's being received well outside of awards, that people are just going to go see it. I just try to do my due diligence, you know, mm-hmm. and how it comes out and how it's perceived at the end of the day is out of my control. But I do like to be prepared
mm-hmm.
so that if in the off chance it does, I'm ready to, you know,
mm-hmm.
Excuse me, how do you say, like, meet the moment, yeah, meet the right, moment.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And now that you are, I guess, entering this new phase in your career, have you noticed a shift in the energy when you walk in the room and the mm-hmm. executives, and what's that been like?
Yeah, now the attraction,
mm-hmm.
the, you walk in the room of people,
mm-hmm.
which is awesome, but it can also be daunting. Mm-hmm. All eyes on you, always on. That's mm-hmm. a lot.
You can handle it. It'll be fine.
I hope so. One step at a time.
Awesome. Well, again, congratulations
Thank on this you. Film.
I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed this chat. Dave, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Your time.
I appreciate it.
Right.
So I mentioned that this, I think, is going to potentially become a Christmas classic. The fact that this film was being released on January 19th in the UK boggles the mind. Why did it not come out a few weeks ago? It makes no sense. Hannah, do you feel like this is a film that you could be returning to and many others in Christmas time in the years to come?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, maybe, yeah, it's a good, you know. I do think it's interesting, though. I don't think it really matters what time of year a Christmas film comes out. Like a film set at Christmas. I don't think it really, I guess, I don't know, because I think there are some, I don't know, when did It's a Wonderful Life come out? Did that come out? And that became a classic, right? Mm-hmm. I also think you don't know if it's going to be a classic until, we always say, oh, this is an instant Christmas classic, but mm-hmm. I'm also like, let's wait 10 years and mm-hmm. see if people are coming back to it, because I guess we're in the media aftermath of seeing it, and mm-hmm. it's not like something I don't know. I'm not a big one for, I want to watch this movie. Like, I don't repeatedly watch the same film anymore, because I just have this too much to watch. So, sorry, I feel like I'm dampening your thing, enthusiasm. I adore this film. I'm sure it will be, I know for some people it's definitely going to be like, I want to watch this every single Christmas. And I totally understand why they would. It's a really kind of really melancholic but kind of beautiful film.
Thank you for pronouncing it correctly. I was going to go with Jake Gyllenhaal there for a second, but you nailed it. You nailed it.
Melancholic. It's melancholy, Dan. It's not the first time today. Jake Gyllenhaal, you will always be famous.
Oh, what a legend. Yeah, I also adored this film. Just the journey that Hunnam, who is the character that Paul Giamatti plays, goes on. And, you know, I found it to be quite funny in terms of the insults he's doling out to students left, right, and center, especially in the early curriculum, which is great. But it's that central relationship between him and the young student played by Dominic Setter that he forms a bond with, and has he slowly sort of defrosts from this curmudgeon that he sort of starts off as. He finds himself to be a kindred spirit.
Defrost, like what you did there.
Yeah, defrost. But yes, what did you make of that sort of central dynamic, Clarice?
That he loves ancient history and has made him very depressed and alone. Didn't relate to it at all. I think kind of structurally, if you take a step back from the holdovers, it's a pretty familiar, mm-hmm. you know, it's a Christmas story of he's the Grinch. Yeah. And then his heart grows two sizes because he meets this poor little sad boy, poor little sad rich boy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the beauty of the holdovers is in the nuances. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm going to jump into performances. I think the reason why that character works so well is because of Paul Giamatti's performance, mm-hmm. because he doesn't play it as bitter. He's not angry at his students, even though it comes across as that, but because Paul Giamatti is such a
he's a fantastic actor.
I don't know, he just has such a kindly energy mm-hmm. on screen. You just get this sense that he's so desperate. He just really wants his kids to care about the Peloponnesian War because he wishes that when he was younger, mm-hmm. He had somebody in his life to bring him the same guidance. And so there's such a really pure intent behind it that it softens a lot of the language. And when he calls them rancid little Philistines.
There's so many.
I get all the little insults. I think he calls a kid a genuine troglodyte.
Yeah. Yes, that cat. Oh my God, I cackle.
I feel like we should bring that insult back.
I want a supercar of him, of all the insults he does.
I'm sure somebody on the internet will guide you in due time. But yeah, Paul Giamatti, long been one of my favourites. If you have not watched Billions, you should make time for that. I love that show, and he's fantastic in it. But yeah, I love the awards attention that he's getting. It's very much deserved. Let's talk about Davine Joy Randolph as Mary the cook here. I feel like a lot of her best work in this film is actually non-verbal. It's mostly silent. It's so intimate in a way that comes across very effectively. What did you make of that performance, Hannah, and the award attention that she's getting?
Well, it's 100% deserved. Mm. I voted for every opportunity I can. There's something about Davine where she's in total control of her body and how she carries herself. And there's something about the way she positions herself in relation to how much respect that she's given a certain person, Mary gives a person in the scene. I think it really balances certainly the kind of, there's so much subtlety in subtext, but about the disparity, you know, because as much as you said, Clarice, this, you know, it's this guy who wants best with boy and this poor little rich boy. It's actually a really interesting talk conversation about who gets, certainly because it's a period piece, so it's set in the 70s, but who gets education, who gets freedom, who gets safety, and what people have to go through.
And freedom to grieve as well. Yeah. That's what I found really interesting, is everyone's sort of grieving something, and I'm using that in a very vague, that's no spoilers, but... Yeah, sorry, I jumped
in. I think it's fair to say that she's lost. I think it's fair, it's pretty much from the beginning, kind of the film, right? So she's lost her son.
Yeah,
And the circumstances of why I guess the way the film unpacks in a very delicate manner, it's like a slow release, slow burn of information, and it's not thrown in your face. It's not I think the closest we got to white saviorism in this film is a scene where this fucking little shit Coots, is that his name? Coots, Kuntz or something? I don't know. It's a cunt, basically.
wow.
I feel like that was purposefully that name because he was a little cunt. They only have the food that's left. And obviously Mary's still working. She's got to work after her son's died in Vietnam. And then he's complaining about when thingy asks him to join, Mary to join us, she's like, he, that little cunt gives that look, and you're like, oh, fuck it. And then suddenly he complains about the food when she leaves, and he goes, smashes the table. It's most like kind of, I was like, oh God, is this going to be like a white savior story? But he kind of checks himself in a way, because it's like, fucking little shit. You don't know what that woman's been through. Like, you know, that line about, you know, some people life is a rickety ladder that's short and like, you know, broken ladder. And I thought, you know, that was like most kind of overt, I suppose, attempt at kind of really grappling with that. But I really liked, sorry, to go back to kind of Davine, but I think she's always in control. I love the way she does the character where she's cool, but there's a scene in the kitchen later on that's just, she knows exactly who Mary is and how protective she is of herself and what she's willing to share. I hope she wins everything, because I think sometimes people go for the obvious performance.
I think you're totally right about that. Because some of the discussions that I've been having with people this award season, they've been a little bit on Davine and have gone for something more showy. But as we've mentioned, a lot of the joy in Davine's performance is because of the restraint.
Her accent's really good.
Yes, she's been talking a lot about that. She learned the Boston accent. She also learned how to smoke on camera. She hadn't done that before. And she really sort of studied how to do that.
She smokes very well.
Yes, she does.
I have a big thing about smoking on camera, because I think a lot of people don't know how to smoke. You can tell when people don't know how to smoke. And it's like, I guess how people smoke is a part of their character and personality. Mm-hmm. So it's just like you're just doing generic smoking, but it's like there's something about where you can actually do it well.
Yeah, I'm really
happy. Hannah, quit smoking.
We've had that conversation. It's all good.
I'm trying. Life's too hard. It's stressful.
I'm really happy for her. Like, the Dolomite Is My Name, which came out in 2019, was a big deal for her. She was the breakout in that as well. Really going toe to toe with Eddie Murphy, which is not easy. And to see her now having all this awards attention is really exciting for her. I'm very excited to see what it's going to mean for her career going down the road. But speaking of performances which maybe don't get as much love as they should, let's be sure to talk about Dominic Sessa here as the young man who forms that bond with Hunnam. I feel like, especially when the other kids leave, initially the first like 20, 30 minutes of this movie, there's other kids who are staying at campus, but there's some sort of narrative stuff that happens that means that they leave, and I'm going to find out the name of this kid. 1 second.
What, the Dominic Sessa character? Yeah. Angus Thank Tully.
And the kids leave and Angus stays. That is when the bond between Angus and Hunnam really starts developing. We start learning more about Angus's situation and why he comes across the way he does. And I feel like that is done very, very well by Dominic Sessa in this. And he has been getting a little bit of award attention, but not as much as I think he should be, Khaleesi.
I thought he's fantastic. I loved, and he is just like straight out of high school, hasn't worked professionally, just found him. Yeah. And he has like a very cool look. I'm like, I believe he's from the 70s.
Yes, yes, and that's such a good point. It really makes a difference.
He looks like this,
Yeah.
And he kind of dresses like Bob Dylan on the red carpet, so I'm sure he's going to have a big career. But I think it's a fantastic performance and also great casting, because just the way that he holds himself, and he's got this kind of like scarecrow body, and the way that he smiles, he does this thing where he kind of smiles, he has this smirk, and it looks painful, and I could just, like, 5 minutes into the movie, you're like, that boy has a lot of trauma, we're going to find out about it, aren't we? And I was proven correct. So I feel like that fantastic, like, physical body language acting, and just, like, I think he just hit the balance right of like the parts of this story that are exploring privilege and like the relationship between grief and privilege and the fact that like yeah, like other characters don't really have avenues to express emotion, and he does have this ability. Like, there's a scene where he goes into a diner and there's a guy playing at the pinball machine, and they have this really stupid fucking argument because he's just angry and he just wants to have an argument with somebody. And I feel like that scene is so telling about his character. I really loved that moment, and I loved how he performed it.
Yeah. I will say this, though. One thing that I thought of it was a bit odd. As someone who's dislocated their little finger, there's he gets an injury which he recovers from pretty quickly. I'm like, wait a second. I think he's really good, though. I think he was very snarky, arrogant in ways. And in a way, there's something of Tom Hanks in him, like a young Tom Hanks that I kind of saw coming out by way of, not Billy Crystal, like a little bit of Dustin Hoffman as well. Like, I don't know. Mm. There's something in it where I'm like, oh, I can see this guy going on to bigger things because he's got this, I don't know, this real...
He's got, like, the new Hollywood vibe.
Yes, he's got such a new Hollywood vibe. Yeah, absolutely. I just want to add before, like, I guess, I don't know if we'll wrap it up, but, like, personally, as a Carthaginian, Tunisian, I love how much Hunnam loves the Punic Wars, and I love this little bit in it where he's like, oh, punitive comes from the Punic Wars, and I'm like, yes, tell him. So yeah, there's a big, like, I like how much Carthage comes up in this film. There's someone who's been to Carthage as well, because Carthage technically still does exist in Tunisia, but they like have an area that's like, this is Carthage. So yeah.
Okay. There you go. It's another thing I didn't know.
I'd love to go there too.
Go. It's so good.
And Marcus Aurelius. I would say the history references were really good because I feel like shouting out the Peloponnesian. And I was looking at all the stuff written on the board. It was like Pericles. I don't read Greek though, so I couldn't figure out what that said. But somebody did their research. I'll say that.
You will not be failing that class, will you?
I know. I would be his best student. Because this is what pissed me off about, was it Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, where Indiana is in the lecture room and no one's listening. I'd be front row, Professor Jones, I have questions.
You'd be like, Leslie, do you remember Leslie Jordan when he goes, Daddy, Daddy, look at me, Daddy. That'll be you.
That would be me.
Oh dear. I just wanted to add, I really like the cinematography in this. I loved that even from the beginning they used the titles for like Universal and I guess Focus Features and all the ones we put, and they used the original ones from the 70s. And I think they really loved that way that kind of brought you into this world, which I guess they shot on film, but it's a real grainy.
I think they didn't.
Did they not? But they
did digital, and I think they added scratches to it.
Oh, okay. Well, they did a very good. It looked good. I like the kind of slightly undersaturated. Like it was kind of really washed out a little bit as well, and I think it wasn't too bold, and that again brings you back. It was like watching, I don't know. It reminded me of when I watched Love Story. Do you remember Love Story? Have you seen Love Story?
Yes, I remember Love Story. That means never having to say you're sorry.
I don't subscribe to that. Say sorry, bitch.
Yeah, I kind of hate that movie, I'll be honest.
Oh, it's insane. But, it was kind of inspired A Walk to Remember, though, right? It was like the...
Yeah. I also want to say the sound mix is mono. It's mono sound, so that's also another... There's all these little things to make it more... Mm-hmm. 70s-esque. Yeah. I didn't hear that because my ears don't work that well, but I read that.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Barton Boys don't lie. And neither do we when it comes to our screen, stream, or skip recommendations.
Nice.
On The Holdovers. Hannah Flint.
Screen.
Clarice Lockery.
Yeah, Screen.
And it's also a screen from me. New Christmas classic. I'm not even waiting 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 10 years. I'm just saying it right now. I really like this film.
I just want to say, though, the poster keeps saying heartwarming. No, I found it extremely depressing.
No.
I don't know who wrote that.
I agree with that. Like, in the end, there's a few heartwarming moments when...
My heart was not warm.
It was wrenched. My heart was wrenched.
It was wrenched.
My heart was not warm.
I don't know. Sometimes people tell me movies are heartwarming, and it's like, what? Made me really sad, but okay. I'm going to stick to watching The Grinch, but you will go have fun.
The Grinch is the ultimate Mean Girl. We are going from the original Mean Girl to a bunch of Mean Girls because we're talking about Mean Girls 2024.
Oh, hell no!
Bitch, move.
Hey, PG-13, please.
What was that?
Oh Lord, it's the queen bee.
Regina George.
Don't look her in the eye!
You could be really hot if you change, like, everything.
Welcome to Health and Human Sexuality.
We'll be getting into abstinence, of course, then followed by in the spring, condoms and choking.
I'm a bitch, I'm a lover, I'm a child, I'm a mother, I'm a sinner, I'm a saint. I do not feel ashamed, I'm your hell, I'm your dream. I'm nothing in between, you know you wouldn't want it any other way. Maybe we would like it the original way. Okay.
That's a big hint in terms of what we
spoilers.
Think about this. Yeah.
Spoilers. New student Katie Heron gets welcomed into the top of the social food chain by an elite group of popular girls called the Plastics, ruled by the conniving queen bee Regina George. However, when Katie makes the major misstep of falling for Regina's ex-boyfriend, Aaron, is it Aaron? It is Aaron, isn't it?
Yeah.
Aaron Samuels. She soon finds herself caught in their crosshairs. Directed by Samantha Jane and Arturo Perez Jr. from a script by Tina Fey, it is an adaptation of the musical based on the movie Mean Girls.
Based on the book.
Based on the book Queen Bees and Wannabes.
Based on the social behavior of
it keeps going. Girls. Yeah. A lot of, there's an adaptive journey. And so it stars Angouri Rice, Renee Rapp, Ali'i Cravallo, Christopher Bruni, Jacquel Spivey, B.B. Wood, and Avantika. I'm not going to lie, I love Mean Girls, the movie, original Lindsay Lohan, Amanda Seyfried, Rachel McAdams. Like, that was very much my personality, and I feel like every day I quote something from Mean Girls. I mean, it's not Heather's, but it, you know, it's second to Heather's for me. So I have a lot of, like, I guess I very much have clung on to the original movie where I was very much kind of, that. I guess my question is why? Why do we need this? So I guess that's kind of my relationship with Mean Girls as an entity. I mean, we don't talk about Mean Girls 2. None of the spin-offs, they don't exist. But I can understand the musical version. Now, Clarice, I know you know more about the musical, original musical, than I do. So I guess for you, how has this adaptation gone from movie to, like, musicals from stage to screen?
They cut a bunch of the songs. So I haven't seen it on stage, but I've seen a slime tutorial, as the theater kids say.
A what?
I watched it online.
Okay.
Don't arrest me. It's called a slime tutorial. It's when people video the musical and they put it online. I know it's really bad.
I've never heard.
It's coming to the West End this year, so I'm going to try and see it.
I've never heard that term before. Slime tutorial.
It's because you're not a cool Gen Z theater kid like I am.
Sure, that's cool.
I'm so fucking down with kids. I would say even on the, like, basis of just translating a musical onto screen, I would say this is not good because they cut quite a few songs. Katie Heron has a lot more singing in the original, the stage musical. And also they cut parts of the songs. So Meet the Plastics, when she's like, my name is Regina, and she's introducing herself in the cafeteria, you're also meant to hear from the other plastics. But in the movie, they just don't introduce those characters. And they're just like, oh, well, you saw the movie, so you know who Karen is. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm struggling to see the effort. The, like, you know, the care and the, like, okay, let's really think about how do we put this into a movie and make the movie interesting and kind of unique and give it a purpose, give us a reason to all be here. That's the thing I'm kind of missing from this movie.
Yeah. Amon, would you, I don't know if you're as much of a musical fan.
I like the odd musical. Not like a huge musical fan, but I like the odd musical.
Did you like this one?
Too much music! No, we're not saying that. I was not familiar with the Mean Girls musical. I was familiar with the original film, although it wasn't as formative for me as it was for yourself, Hannah. I had a really good time with this, I gotta say. I thought the songs were great. I thought Vinay Rap... I understand that, from what you're saying, more focus is put on her, Regina George, in the movie than it is in the musical, and definitely is in the original film. But Renee Rapp has such a presence about her that I didn't mind that at all. Her delivery of songs is great. And we should mention that Renee Rapp, this is her reprising the role that she did on Broadway on screen. And I just thought that she was freaking phenomenal. When she says... My name is Regina George and I am a massive deal. You fully believe that. She sells you on that. Yeah, I thought that was great. In terms of the update and the why of it all, plot-wise, it's not surprising that they haven't changed it because Mean Girls is such an incredible screenplay and Tina Fey is, you know, has tweaked it a little bit for this film. In terms of the update of it all, I think they do a lot of interesting stuff with the how social media plays a role in the story and how that is shown on screen. I feel like that's really dynamic direction. At multiple points, I felt that. So that to me is where most of the update stuff comes from, not really from the plot. And I don't mind that because why would you change such a good story? No, Mean Girls is Mean Girls for the reasons it is. And so I didn't mind that we didn't get much of a difference between this version and other versions.
See, this is where I disagree because there is some... Fine, sure, the basic plot elements, it does exactly the same. That's what it does the same. And sure, okay, it's updated it to say, oh, look, people wouldn't... You wouldn't print out the burn book. You'd... put it down and people turn poters and that'll get go viral that way. Fine. That's like a kind of like very basic thing that I think most people do nowadays. Like my biggest problem with this movie musical is it does what all these goddamn movie musicals do is sanitize the source material. This is called Mean Girls. This was more like a bit unkind girls. The sharpness, the edges have been softened. You know, certain jokes, like, they just didn't hit for me. I mean, I guess the one thing I do think, and I mentioned it to you, Clouse, I was like, oh, I'm glad they didn't say she's from Africa. You know, she was in Africa. They said she's from Kenya. She's been in Kenya. Because I think I mentioned it before. We're talking about Monica. I was like, oh, like, Africa's a continent. Pick a country that she was in. That's about it. But they don't do that joke of, like, if you're from Kenya, why are you white? Which is a fucking great joke. I think the Karen in this is quite ditzy. And she plays up a bit more than Amanda Seyfried in a far more, like, I don't know. It was kind of like she was... on MDMA the whole time. She seemed very drugged up or like, I don't know, too much CBD. I don't know, whatever. But
I thought it was funny.
yeah, but it was fine. But I guess like the sharpness of it had gone for me. Some of the big things that they took out, the relationship with a PE teacher and one of the students. The whole thing with Gretchen Wieners and Regina, she doesn't get a candy cane and suddenly it's like she gives this big talk about Brutus. That's such a good scene. Or like talking about the white hoop earrings, you know, that's taking out. And to get, I guess, to make room for songs that for me, spoon feed. Like, it was trying so hard to say, be good people, rather than allowing it to be what it already is, saying teenage girls are cruel and mean. We just accept our differences, it's fine. Can just still have this kind of real energy, this kind of, like, I don't know, like, acerbic tone, then still have this kind of message at the end. And it felt like an alternate universe, Mean Girls, that was just not as good.
I agree, because I mean, it's been 20 years since the original, and the idea that it's just, yeah, there's just, like, no attempt to actually sit down and think about what teenagers are like now, because they're still fucking assholes, but they speak in different, they're mean in different ways. And so I feel like, either, to me, there's no point making this unless you're going to talk about, like, I don't know, how now it's all kind of like there's weird coded language, and yeah, people won't just say a slur to you, but they'll, like, you pack it underneath something. Like, I'm seeing on TikTok at the moment, like, there's a thing where people keep saying, is she acoustic, which really is the new, like, R slur, because they want to say autistic. And, like, that's the way that teenagers bully each other now. And I feel like if this movie had at least made an attempt to do that, I would have had a lot more interest in it. But I will say, what I loved about Renee Rapp's performance is that I think she tried to do that. She tried to think, okay, what would a modern day Regina George act like? And so her performance is actually really different from Rachel McAdams. It's very, like, oh my God, I'm, like, so over it, whatever, like, ugh. Like, very detached, kind of very mature as well.
I guess she's stuck within the framework, because there are certain things, again, it's like trapped by the original Mean Girls where it wants to do the same thing. And so it's like, and so that's what I think you're totally right. There is something, for me, she's also, her singing voice in this, what I love about it is that it's not a musical theatre singing voice. It sounds like Billie Eilish. It sounds like a pop singer rather than, like, the very, like, I don't know, there's a very musical theatre way of singing that's, like, over-articulated, where she has this really nice, like, throaty kind of, like, warble, like, slight warble, but it's a caress.
It's sexy. It's, she sexy. Has a really hot voice.
She's a very sexy, she has a caress. She caresses the lyrics, and that's what I really like about it. But then there's things where she has to say the things, like, oh, you're really pretty. So you agree, you're pretty. But I have Rachel McAdams doing it in such a specific way that is perfect. So whenever, so it's like, it's this, she's stuck. She's caught between a rock and a hard place where it's like, I really want to do this my own version of Regina George. But if I'm given the same lines of dialogue that the original one has, how do I, because this is the thing, it's kind of saying,
they should have let her write it. I feel like she should have been a co-writer, because she knows things, Renee Rapp. I don't know if you've seen her interviews.
Oh, yeah. She's very funny. Oh my God. I love what she was like about Megan Thee Stallion. And Megan Thee Stallion's in it. It was so random that she was in it. Okay. It's just like, why is she here? She doesn't even go here. I mean,
exactly. I love Megan Thee Stallion. And when she turned out, I was like, what?
Yeah. I think it's that thing where it works if you're taking, if you're basically doing Mean Girls and putting it on a stage. What you're saying is, this is the same thing. This is the same thing, but you're making a different stage version medium of it. But when you take that stage version and then put it back on the screen, it's like Inception. It's like a weird thing where it's trying to be fresh and new, but it's also fundamentally supposed to adhere to the original. And that's what the difficulty is.
It's the uncanny valley, Mean Girls.
It's just, yeah, pulling its punches a bit and not really throwing itself into what could have been a really interesting cultural update of this film, but being held back by this nostalgia, I guess, and also the fact that it's a musical based on Mean Girls.
I didn't have it in my brain as I was watching this film, and I feel like that helped with my overall experience. I feel like if people don't have that core memory with them when they see this, they might have a better time with this. I will also say that for me, a scene stealer in this was Jacquel Spivey as Damien. Every moment that he's in, he makes the most of. I wish he was in it more. I heard that one of the songs that they removed was one of his big numbers, and I'm really intrigued as to what that might have been. He himself is a Broadway veteran. I'm not sure if he did this specific role, but he's a Broadway veteran, but he absolutely nailed Damien. I pretty much laughed every time he said a line. It was very consistently funny. So I enjoyed that side of things as well. This film is not better than the original. I feel, though, if people haven't seen the original and they sort of, for whatever reason, were introduced to the concept of Mean Girls through this film, they'd have a good time and hopefully would make them want to check out the original, which is, I agree, superior.
Can I just shout out Ali Carvalho? Yes. I love her. She's an incredible voice. I thought she's such like good presence that she has a song at the end that I thought was like the best part of the movie, just because she was like running around, nailing it, being amazing.
I'd Rather Be Me is what it's called. It's my favorite song of the movie as well. I love it.
It's great. And she seems cool. I follow her on Instagram. Mm. And I like that she's not doing the live action Moana because she was like, I want someone with a darker toned skin to do it because it's more accurate. Mm. Seems cool. Cool lady.
Yeah, she did a really good job on Janice. I did like those. I think for me it was Janice, Damien, and Regina were the best one. And, you know, props for making lesbian...
And none for you.
And none for you, Gretchen Wieners. Sorry. I'm glad they made the lesbian...
Not to single her out. We're not singling her out.
No, I know. She's a good actor, I guess. Just all of it. It's just a bit... They was going to release this straight to Paramount, I guess.
Paramount Plus.
And, That would have been anyway.
That would have been nice.
This is out in cinemas now. So I'm on screen, stream, or skip.
Screen.
Sorry, did I say that a little, what?
Screen, Hannah Inez Flint. Screen, Mean Girls 2024. Yes, I said it. Deal with it.
Shots fired. Clarice?
I would say skip and just watch. I actually think the Ariana Grande video is quite funny, so I just watch that instead with Mama Jenna in the aisles.
Oh,
it's pretty funny.
You've just reminded me of Busy Phillips. I'm going to say skip before I get into another rant. Okay, bro. So I guess from high school drama, Apocalyptic Nightmares. This is the end we start from.
Do you want to go and have some dinner?
Well, I don't know you.
I don't know you either. Could be a disaster.
It isn't real anymore.
Hi.
What you miss doesn't exist.
What's going on?
I'm just like having a moment, you know.
I tried so hard and come so far. But in the end, it doesn't really matter. 'Cause there's... water in my house.
So much water.
And I've got a baby, and I don't know where Joe Fry is. Where is he? This is the end we start from. When an environmental crisis sees London submerged by floodwaters, a young family is torn apart in the chaos. As a woman and her newborn try and find their way home, the profound novelty of motherhood is brought into sharp focus. Directed by Mahalia Bello, from a script by Alice Birch, it stars Jodie Comer, Catherine Waterston, Benedict Cumberbatch, Mark Strong, Joel Fry, Gina McKee, and Nina Sosania. So I feel like as somebody who spent the past year dealing with extreme water damage in my home. Feel like this story hit quite close to home. But I actually kind of want to start. What I found really interesting about it is the Joel Fry character, the partner. There's this idea that in the movie, he's sort of not, he's really not the focus of it, but he's going off and he's doing stuff. And I feel like he's living the Hollywood action movie, because there's an implication that there's like, yeah, there's like fights, mm-hmm. and he's going on this massive journey and he's like all like muddy and bloody. But this instead is sort of, I guess, turning the camera to the character that is usually in the background of these kinds of disaster movies, which is the mother and the baby. So, hey, Hannah, is it an interesting way to put it?
It is. That's such a perceptive thing, Therese. You're very good at your job. No, it is.
Thank you.
And I guess, there's this, you know, not saying it's the same, they're very completely different in so many ways, but like Leave the World Behind is kind of, instead of what, you know, or like, you know, 10 Cloverfield Lane, you know, there's something going on. And instead of folk being at the center of it, you're on the periphery. And I think that's a really interesting way to go about it. And it's also, there's a sense of this unknowing, not really knowing what's going on, that kind of pushes, keeps the tension simmering. Because you're like, what? Nowhere is safe. And I think that's a really difficult thing. And I think what I really like about this film, it's probably when we think about what's going on in the world, what's going on in Gaza. It's like, this is kind of what I imagine it'd be like, a woman and a mother who's a woman and a child about to have a baby, and then suddenly they get bombed. And it's like, where is safety? How do I go? Then you're trying to get food and stuff like that. So it's like, for me, this is such an amazing film, because it is in a sense of, so often I think we need to see Brits in these situations. You know, sci-fi is such an interesting way to kind of delve into these things, because it's kind of like, look, this is what it's like when you're fighting for your life and there's no food left, and suddenly, you know, then people are going to take up arms, and then it becomes a dog-eat-dog world. And, you know, people who are kind of, but you don't know what's going on in the wider thing, because there's no communication. So I think for me, it was a really prescient, I guess, film that really spoke to the kind of the humanity, and I guess trying to hold on to that humanity when the world is crumbling around you and, you know, infrastructure's breaking down and stuff like that. So I think that's what I really enjoyed about it. You know, I think we need more of the films where it's not about some, you know, action person blasting people to safety. You know, it's actually, what is it like to have that human experience of fearing for your life and feeling like literally when it's the end of the world, and then you've brought a baby into the world, and so keeping that baby alive, you know, and so yeah, I really appreciate, I guess, the timing of this sort of film, but also the delicacy with which it approaches this sort of subject.
The more and more now, we're getting films and TV shows which have dystopias that are less fantastical. Partially because of...
I mean, yeah, I would argue it's not really a sci-fi. It's just, this is going to be, like, in 5 years' time.
Exactly right.
Not to be bleak, but...
Yeah,
yeah, does, you know what, doesn't... that's right. I guess it's dystopian, but, like...
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we're not going to discuss it in any detail, but The Kitchen is also released this week, and that's another film that's...
Oh my God, is it out this week?
It's out today. And that's another film that feels very near in terms of the timeline of where we currently are and what that says. So,
well, Aman, I wanted to ask a bit more about, I will say, the one thing that I just kept me a little bit of a distance from this movie is because there's a lack of, you know, traditional action and plot, and it's really about kind of waiting around and waiting and trying to, yeah, get to safety. There's a lot of Mahalia Bello, the director, there's a lot of visual symbolism. Mm. So the opening is like, the flood waters is like the flood of the water breaking, but it's also like the flood of, you know, catastrophe and really isn't giving birth, just like your house being flooded. I found that I appreciate where it was coming from. I struggled with some of that, and there are other versions of it throughout the movie. But Aman, what did you just think about, you know, the pacing and the tone of it?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of symbolism in this movie, and yeah, it starts from the first scene and continues on. The pacing, at times, it was a little bit tedious. But I was mostly compelled and with it all the way through the film, partially because of Jodie Comer's performance, because I'm sure we're going to get into that. But also, it's less about plot, as you say, and more about the state of mind that she's in as she contemplates this new world that she's brought her baby into. And that sort of is a journey in and of itself that I do feel is paced very well over the course of the film. I think the addition of Catherine Waterston's character also adds a lot to that dynamic, because that's a bit of light in a very dark, moody film. And that's like the good side of what humans can do to support one another in times such as these, when a lot of the other people that woman who is what the credits say is Jodie Comer's character, who she comes across, there are other examples where it's not as good. So I feel like that character and that relationship helped things along as well. But yes, at times, it is a little bit tedious with the pacing.
Yeah, let's talk about the two. So I just want to clarify, none of the characters are named in this, so this is why we're all talking vaguely. But the two women, the Jodie Comer's character and Catherine Waterston's character. I'll let you guys talk about Jodie Comer, who is great in this. But my favorite performance was Catherine Waterston. I love her, and I loved the character that she was playing, which was this someone with the impulse for like a caretaker. She has such a desperation to care for everyone around her and to be the light and to be the joy. But God, there's just these moments where you see something pass behind her eyes. And Catherine Waterston has these like big, but brown, beautiful eyes. And you see something pass and it's like, fuck. Again, kind of like Dominic Sessa in The Holdovers. I love performances where you just catch something for a second, you're like, oh, this woman's been through some shit. So I loved her in this. But Hannah, do you want to talk about... Sorry, Catherine Waterston praying.
I was just listening to Clarice talk, and there's one scene that stands out to me. I think it's early on when they first meet each other, actually, Jodie Comer and Catherine Waterston's characters, and they're talking about their partners not being there. And...
Oh my God, yes.
So when you're talking about that and sort of seeing something pass, I think they both do it in that scene. And the camera sort of zeroes in on both of them as they do it. And it's fantastic acting. So yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of love that Jodie Comer's character. There's just a little detail of like, she does hair on a breakfast TV show. That kind of explains, I guess, her characterization for, because I've kind of met those women. I don't know, there's something, the absence of Joel from her partner, I could tell was a big thing for her. And like, how do I, when I actually have to step up. So Catherine Waterston, again, we're going into that thing of, she's so good. She's so kind of somewhat brash and open and like quite like, I'll say it as it is. You can tell she used to work in a certain, you know, certain place in her life where she made a bit of money. I mean, how does she get to this like specific, there's a whole thing where there's an island where it seems to be also like, if you've got enough money, you can afford to go and stay on an island and kind of ignore everything that's going on. But I guess like for me, that's that, again, that sort of this uncertainty and not being quite so sure of herself. And then how do I survive and keep this baby alive when I'm separated? So I guess I really appreciated this sort of how she wasn't this, she was quite a vulnerable person and quite very scared. But then also, I guess the longer you're in it, there's a sense of resolve, which I kind of, and I felt like I really went on that Jodie with Jodie Comer. And I like that. But I also really like Joel Fry. I thought he was amazing. Yeah, right. I mean, we don't see it, but God, the way he performs after coming back from trying to get food and something traumatic happens, like you're with him. You're like, oh my God. He has witnessed something horrendous. Yeah, it's weird that, you know, again, people being ignored from award season conversation. I was surprised that Joel Fry has not been mentioned, but I guess, yeah. But, it, you know, I did love Catherine Waterston. She's great. But I guess it's that sort of character where she's kind of, there's this kind of like charismatic dynamism with her. I feel like with the character Jodie Comer, there's a lot going on that she's keeping to herself, I guess. Because I guess I sometimes feel if she gives voice to it, it's too much, you know?
But I mean, I like when she gives voice to it through talking to her baby. I think those scenes are really, really well done.
Yeah.
Jodie Comer really taps into something primal about motherhood in this film.
Yeah.
Which is great. And she's just one of the most instinctive actors I think we have working today. And you have to be when you're working with babies.
Yeah.
And she's great.
I thought the cinematography was really beautiful in this, and how they did the special effects, the practical effects of the water filling up. I thought that was, there's this, you know, scene earlier where there's a flood. I guess that's what we can say. It's a natural disaster that it's a flood. Mm-hmm. I guess it's about climate, you know, sea levels rising and all that. And I thought that was done really, really well. For a low budget indie, it was quite beautiful and, I don't know, ethereal in some ways. It wasn't a typical like, rah, 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 water, water, water. It was quite, yeah.
Right, I think that brings us to our screen stream or skip on the end we start from. Hannah, Amon.
I am going to say screen. Just. I really liked Anna Meredith's score in this, which has some really pulsing percussion, which I think is done really well.
I'm going to say stream, because I loved the idea. I loved large parts of it, but I think it's just a personal taste. The stuff's a little too on the nose on the symbolism. I'm like, I didn't need that. I'm smart. Don't need, I can understand what's going on.
Question before we move into hot take. Would you like to go and get some dinner work on you?
What?
That's what Joel finds. That's the meet cute. But...
Oh, would you like to get... I can't remember. What's the context again? I mean, if Joel Fry came up to me and said, would you like to get some dinner? I'd be like, yes, Joel Fry. You're very handsome. No, I don't... So I guess the answer is yes. I might
try it out one day. Hey, would you like to go and get some dinner?
Oh, you ask if it's... I mean, I feel like it's pretty... Hannah, I feel like you're better at this. Is that the way to ask somebody out? Would you like some dinner?
I like it. I think it's cute.
Right. Well, as you were saying about, you know, maybe people who aren't getting the shout-outs they deserve, I think that leads us perfectly into our...
Oh, I was really going into like, do you remember the piracy? You wouldn't steal a car. You wouldn't steal a bus. You wouldn't steal 1.5 million from a safe. Don't steal movies. Privacy is a crime. Do not accept it. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
Yep. That's what I'll do. We'll just go into random adverts even every time.
Still a fixture on many of my DVDs, that piracy warning. Fun times.
Great. I love it. So on Thursday, because this is coming out, so you're listening to this on Sunday, maybe, probably. The nominations for the 2024 BAFTA Awards came out, and I genuinely don't know where to start because I was reading them, and this is why I tweeted that reading them felt like I was being kissed gently on the head and then slapped just over and over again, because some of them are fantastic, and then some of them are very like, huh? So I don't know where to start. Does anyone have anything that, nothing particularly, well, no Lily Gladstone made me want to like go and stand in the corner and scream. But that's my burden to deal with. Did anything else jump out at people?
The first thing that jumped out at me was no Greta Gerwig for director, which was very surprising. I think she directed the hell out of Barbie. I was really expecting to see her there. And some of the other stuff that jumped out at me is just like, you consider one thing for one category, and then for another category, there's nothing representing that thing you just consider. Like, Best Film has Killers of the Flower Moon. Martin Scorsese isn't in Best Director. You nominate All of Us Strangers for Best Casting. Andrew Scott isn't nominated for Best Actor. It's just like, I don't understand how that works. So yeah. That type of stuff is jumping out at me. I was pleasantly surprised by Vivian O'Hara, getting the Best Actress nod, which, you know, I really liked her performance in Rylane. I'm very, very happy for it. As I said, as you say, no Lily Gladstone was like, huh, I don't know about that. So yeah, I mean,
it genuinely makes me want to scream because that to me is like the best performance in just like in this year, years, multiple maybe. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you have Teo Yu for Past Lives. We don't have Greta Lee for Past Lives. That's what.
The Past Lives erasure in this thing, and for it to be only nominated in the best film, not in an English language, that pissed me off. It just confirms to me just how much of it is a racket, how much awards are a racket, because it's about who you can get to go to the screenings, who's going to turn up, and because there's. You know, I spoke to my friend, like, the fact that there's no May-December on this is wild to me. Like, May-December is amazing. I guess it's just because, I don't know.
And Charles Melton wasn't even on the long list. He didn't even have a chance.
But a friend of mine said that he didn't even, I should have seen it, but I didn't, even though it's available. And I guess it's like, you've seen how much Killers of the Flower Moon, All of the Strangers, like, I don't think there was much for May-December, but I also think it's such a... It just is so obvious to me. This is so boring, and it's so like, oh, of course you pick these. And even like, I get Barbie, but also like, I don't get Barbie. Like, I think it's a great film, but like, I don't, like, there are so many other films that came out this year that I just feel a bit disappointed that there's no recognition. And I guess, I don't know. It's kind of unsurprising, but also I'm surprised that certain things didn't get considered. Like, you know, like Kokomo City, that, I mean, it pissed me off that even Critics Circle didn't even recognize that one.
I did like that Across the Spider-Verse is getting the nominations for the score. You know, I still feel like Across the Spider-Verse should be in contention for best film. Don't even put the animated monarch on it. I think it's that good. I think it deserves to be in that situation. It hasn't been this award season.
I don't.
I know you don't. I'm saying I do.
It's not that I don't think it's that good. I guess I just don't think. I think Into the Spider-Verse, 100%, I'd agree on like best picture category, but no.
Yeah.
I also just think it's about people who want to get people bums on seats, so like who do you want to see at the awards, you know?
I could believe that more with Golden Globes. I would hope that BAFTA aspires to be better than that, but. Robert Downey Jr. looks to be a lock for Oscars, given all the awards that he's been winning for his performance in Oppenheimer, and he's nominated again here. Personally, I think, you know, Ryan Gosling's Barbie, I think he's just phenomenal in that. So that's the one that I've been mostly going for. But Robert Downey
Jr. Fight for you, Charles Melton. I will stand by your side to the bitter end. You are my best supporting actor.
Dominic Sessa, who we were just talking about, he got a BAFTA nomination for The Holdovers. That was a pleasant
surprise. Good for him. I hope he dresses up like Bob Dylan again.
Yeah. What do you make of the love for Saltburn? Because Jacob Elordi got nominated.
I don't understand it at all. Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that Andrew Scott didn't get nominated. I mean, yeah. I think there's a thing as well about, like, if I look at the films... I guess for me, it's like, I just wish there, it becomes this thing where you just wish more diversity would be recognised in diversity of story. Like,
there's one other category I do want to discuss briefly. The BAFTA Rising Star Award. I think we need clarification on what exactly Rising Star pertains to. Because Ira Edebiri is part of this list, but she's like been winning Golden Globes and Emmys and all that sort of stuff, and yeah, it feels like she is already a star, not a rising star. But
it got, I feel like it's someone who's blown up in the past year, right? That wouldn't make sense to me. It's more when they've cast somebody who's been like, I feel that this year I'm okay with it. Because like Jacob Elordi, you know, he had Euphoria, but with Elvis and Saltburn, like he's like arrived. And I feel like Ayo Edebiri with The Bear and... Bottoms this year, like she arrived, and then it's like Mia McKenna-Bruce,
Phoebe Dynevor, and Sophia Wilde.
How could I forget Theatre Camp?
She had an incredible year.
Phoebe Dynevor.
Phoebe Dynevor.
Yeah, that one's I think to me is the most quick because like I don't think she's blown up more than she did on Bridgerton with Fair Play. That's a bit strange, that one. Exactly. But
and she was in one, and it's like she was in the one season of Bridgerton, and then she's like a side character in the rest of them.
Yeah.
With her, the reason why I'm okay with that is because Fair Play came out during the strikes, and I feel like if the strikes weren't a factor, a lot more people would have been talking about that performance at the time.
It's a Netflix film.
Yeah.
No, I don't think they would. I think it was a fine movie. I don't think it was like, oh my God, show stopping.
I thought she was fantastic in it.
I don't know. But you also have to remember it's done by committee. They get a load of people into a room and they decide who they want to do it. And part of it is like, who's starry enough? It's voted by the public. So I don't really care about it, to be honest. Like, I think it's, you know, it's just another award that's kind of picking and choose who's the hot young things at the moment. I certainly think it should, in a way, I think a rising star should be acknowledging people instead of people who have arrived or breakthrough, whatever. Like, you could say that Greta Lee is breakthrough because she's been supporting for so many years and she did that speech, right? She did that speech, was at Critics Circle. Actually, if EU Rising Star was really doing it, it should be ones who have, like, who actually are, like...
Like Vivian O'Para, because she's, right, like...
People who are so kind of, like, promise. They've done one... like, something like, oh, they've done this one thing and we really want to see what they do next. Like, you know...
Or McKenna Bruce. I feel
great
to see her there.
Perfect, perfect. That's what I consider, like, or even, like, you know, again, I mean, some of the kids in that, like Sean Thomas and Samuel Bottom, like, but you know what I mean? That's, for me, what a rising star should be. It's like, let's use this as a platform to give people who aren't already a winning award. Like, I mean, you know, Daniel Kaluuya got rising star when he was already, I just don't deny that he doesn't deserve it, but you know, anyway, so I guess awards makes losers out of winners. Everyone's a winner. Everyone contributed something great.
Everyone's a winner, baby.
99% of people did.
You're a winner, and you're a winner, and you're a winner. But yeah, I'm looking forward to discussing with you guys in terms of award season and what it might mean for speeches. Maybe we'll do that in a later hot take.
Thanks for tuning in and happy viewing via whatever medium is safest for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It makes a difference. And tweet us any questions or hot takes at Fade to Black Pod on Twitter. I'm at Clarice Liu on Twitter, at Clarice Lockery on Instagram. I'm on Letterboxd.
I am at Amon Woman on Twitter and Instagram.
I'm at Hannah Ernest Flint on Instagram and Letterboxd. I'm truly trying hard to update this on this shit because I have my little Excel spreadsheet, but I'm like, I'm committed. Yeah. To log in all my films this year. We'll see.
Oh my God. And happy 10-year anniversary to one of my favorite movies ever made, Inside Llewyn Davis. Yes. I love you. I watched it twice in 2 weeks. I watch it every January because it's the ultimate January movie. It makes me feel so terrible. Love it. Recipe.
Please, Mr. Kennedy. I don't want to go running in outer space.
Well. If it isn't new and it never gets old, then it's a Fade to Black podcast episode. Farewell, film friends. It's time to fade to black.